Okay. Right, thank you very much for coming tonight. I can promise you you're in for a treat. No pressure. Mary Nadeski, really, I find, is one of the most interesting and definitely independent-minded journalists that we have in the UK. And independent-minded in a way that she writes what normally most other journalists would not write. Detect something that is unusual. Just recently, I think roughly 5 days ago, in the Independent, I found it hugely interesting, about Boris Johnson, also about Boris Johnson, that he called for people to demonstrate outside the Soviet embassy. Recently, actually, you wrote a huge U-turn, and no one really noticed it. It was buried in a small notice that he's going to visit Moscow. And Mary wrote a beautiful piece about it, explaining it and explaining that it's huge. So that is the kind of thing you can expect from her. And obviously, she is very knowledgeable because she was correspondent in Moscow, in Paris, in Washington, studied in Moscow, and traveled there again and again, has access to Putin and to quite a few of the elite intellectuals and academics in Russia, and obviously the other countries as well.
Thank you. Well, thank you for the invitation, and thank you to Imke, especially for the introduction. Hugely generous, and I'd like to be generous in return, because Imke, in her slightly previous incarnation when she was being a full-time journalist, was one of also the most interesting of the European correspondents in London. So I think everybody who's being taught by Imke is incredibly lucky. So that's my my reciprocation. What I thought I would do is I'd like to divide what I'm going to say into two parts. And I'm going to speak on themes, I'm going to speak from talking points. About a month ago, I was invited to give a lecture at another university, and it was organized a year in advance. I mean, with journalists, you can never organize anything a year in advance, but this was organized a year in advance, and it was a named lecture. And so I'd done my homework and I produced a script so I could give a formal lecture. And when I arrived, the person meeting me who'd given the invitation, I said, oh, you know, I've got my here. And he looked at it in total horror. And he said, but you've not got a text that you're going to read. And I said, well, I did rather. He said, well, we usually find that talking points are more successful. So I had about half an hour to reduce this written through prose and argument to talking points. So today I'm starting with talking points. So you won't have the benefit of connected prose, but I hope at least it will be interesting. As I say, I'm going to talk on two topics. The first one is to look at the whole issue of Trump and Russia, which is how the title for this Trumped Up came into being. Because, as Imke suggested to you, I mean, I do take a rather different and very minority view on the whole business of Trump and Russia. And the second thing is, second topic, which is not unrelated, but I think is separate, at least in my mind, is to look at some of the differences between American and British journalism. Because I think when you're in the UK, at least, and so, you know, if you're in America, but you don't actually ever cross the two cultures, you actually assume that the two things are rather similar. And actually, in journalism, this is one of the areas where I would say that the differences in culture are gigantic, far more than you would expect, say, by picking up a copy of the New York Times and a copy of, say, the London Times. You would not realise the different backgrounds and the different assumptions that go into making those two different publications. So that's just by way of an introduction. I thought on the subject of Trump and Russia, I mean, I followed this from a very early stage, and I followed it for two reasons. I followed it because of my sort of interest in Russia and because I've worked in Washington for 5 years, but also because there was something about this preoccupation, the way that the Russia card, it seemed to me, kept being played through the latter stages of the American presidential election, and the use that was made of it, and to my mind, the totally uncritical interpretation of... there was sort of a consensus almost before anything happened, before Trump, long before Trump's election, there was a consensus that sort of Russia equals attempt to manipulate the election equals bad. And I'm actually not sure that either of those is true, and I'm not sure that the evidence is there. If you look at it very closely, I'm not convinced that the evidence for those two assumptions is nearly as watertight as most people tend to believe. The first point I'd say is that the question of the hacking of the Democrat National Committee, that's in a way where we all came in. And what initially happened was that this was blamed on the Russians, even though it appeared that it actually wasn't necessarily the Russians. It wasn't even necessarily any foreigners. That it was to do with, it was equally to do with internal election politicking inside the United States. We still don't know who did that initial hacking. The second thing was that even if Russians were involved in hacking, I would bet you that an awful lot of people were involved in hacking, not just the Democrat National Computer, but trying to hack the Republican National Computer as well. Because this was a very peculiar election campaign. It was peculiar because the assumption throughout was that Hillary Clinton was the favourite. She'd got the establishment on her side. She was going to get elected. And it was peculiar because Trump was never the favoured candidate on the other side. It was sort of remarkable that he passed every every trial, every test, every primary. He sort of surmounted each obstacle after obstacle, only to win the prize in the end, to be the sort of survivor of this, what often seems to me rather like a sort of medieval tournament. And so it was a very peculiar election that nobody really knew how to call from outside. And I would be very surprised if the intelligence services of other countries, including our own, were not hugely interested in what was going on inside the various campaigns, and if they didn't use all the tools that they had at their disposal, whether it was chatting up or trying to compromise people inside the campaigns, or whether it was using the technology. I very much doubt whether it was just Russians that were using technology. And I would say that there is a gigantic difference between using the technology, hacking, to try to find out what was going on, which I bet a lot of people were doing, and using the same technology to try and manipulate the election, which is what the Russians are exclusively accused of doing. And I find it very difficult to accept this. I find it difficult to accept it from a purely logical and rational point of view, because there is absolutely no evidence that I can see from anything that any high-powered Russian has said, whether on the record or being caught out and saying off the record, nothing that any Russian has said that suggests they actually wanted Donald Trump to be elected. And there are some very good reasons why Russia would not want Donald Trump to be elected. One of them is that although they didn't like Hillary Clinton and they suspected her of being sort of predisposed in a rather hostile way towards Russia, she was at least a known quantity, and she was predictable, and Russians like predictability. And Donald Trump really is unpredictability personified. It doesn't seem to me, I mean, and I was in Russia in October, just a few weeks before the actual American election, and there was no evidence that I could find, either in the Russian media, on state television, from officials, from meeting with officials, nothing that I could find that suggested they were favouring Trump. When we had, I'm part of this group called the Valdai Group, which is a sort of annual conference and has a, it ends every year with a sort of free-for-all question and answer with Putin. And because there are American participants in the Valdai Group, there were a lot of questions about the American election, about the hacking scandal. And Putin himself said, I mean, first of all, he tried to, he laughed off the idea of Russian manipulation, saying, you know, who do you think, why do you think that Russians would think that they were able to manipulate an American presidential election, as though this was some banana republic, he said, in that exactly that phrase. And, of course, you can say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But he also said, we haven't taken sides in this election. And that's entirely true. He said, yes, we like what Trump says about wanting to improve relations with Russia. We think that's a good thing. But that depends on Americans voting for the president that they vote for. We haven't, you know, we haven't expressed a preference. And all these stories that you hear and you see about sort of Russians drinking champagne in the Kremlin on the moment Trump's election was announced, I mean, this is simply not true. People say, one of the things they're looking at is the Russian parliament, the Duma, where apparently when the election was, result was announced to the Duma, there were cheers. Well, there would be, wouldn't they? I mean, from a Russian audience, especially a rather conservative Russian audience, anything that went against the American establishment in the Russian parliament is going to draw approval. The only person who is actually quoted as having raised a glass of champagne at the election of Donald Trump is Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who is not part of the ruling establishment in Russia. He is a far-right politician, a populist and demagogue who has never, whose support has rarely been enough to get even more than a handful of representatives in the Russian parliament. Again, if you were looking for somebody who was going to raise a glass at the election of Donald Trump as an anti-establishment figure, as seen by the Russians, then it would be Vladimir Zhirinovsky. This doesn't mean anything in terms of the stance of the of official Russia. I think you also have to look at the sort of West's assumption and the assumption of Americans. From very early on, they were fed this line that Russia was, it was Russia that was interfering in the elections. And that Russia had also interfered in the Brexit referendum in the UK. That Russia is also going to interfere, try to manipulate, not just trying to find out what's going on, but trying to manipulate the result in their favour, including in the coming European elections. I mean, I find this very, very difficult to believe. First of all, that they would they would even believe that their manipulation would have a chance of success, or that they would actually have an idea of what success would be. You know, I hear all sorts of people saying, oh, well, they just want, to use the Soviet phrase, they're just interested in fishing in troubled waters, and they just want to create chaos, they just want to create instability, they just want to do Europe down, or Germany, or the UK, or the Americans, or whatever. I actually don't think that's true, because of what I said before about Russia preferring a predictable world, a stable world. I think the last thing that they actually wanted or expected was for the UK, for instance, to vote for Brexit. And again, you know, there is no evidence for this other than the sort of suspicion just because Russia is mentioned. So I suppose the most up to date accusations that have applied to Russia in the US apply to the transition after Trump's election. Then people have accused members of Trump's entourage of cultivating or being chatted up by or associating with known Russian security people or people with high-level contacts in Russia. And so several of very senior people in Trump's entourage are accused of meeting such people. Now, one of the people that they met, and we know they met, because, would you believe, his phone was being hacked. And who was it being hacked by? By the American Secret Service, which then put some of the little bits, selected bits of transcripts into the public domain when Trump was already the president-elect, which I think is highly dubious practice. But the particular Russian who was being monitored in this way and who Trump officials were being accused of meeting was the Russian ambassador in Washington. Now, immediately after Trump's election, the British ambassador in Washington got into huge trouble because it was said, you know, it's come to a pretty pass where the most senior member of the sort of British diplomatic corps, which is the premier post ambassador in Washington, that he didn't have sufficient contact in the trade. He'd put all his eggs in the Clinton basket. British diplomats hadn't cultivated the Trump team. They didn't know anybody. They didn't have contacts. There you've got Nigel Farage, who was sort of welcomed in Trump Tower, British ambassador nowhere. He was hugely criticised for this. I mean, it seems to me that the members of the Trump team and the Russian ambassador and Russian officials were doing exactly what they're supposed to do in these circumstances, which was to establish and maintain contacts, probably with both camps. But because Trump was this sort of outside candidate, because there were suspicions of the Russian links, suddenly all this became suspect. And there was a point about a week ago where I thought to myself, you know, maybe I'm just getting this completely wrong. Maybe it is very suspect that Trump officials were meeting Russians, including the ambassador. And then I was sort of saved because Jack Matlock, who is now a professor at, I can't remember which American university, but he was the ambassador of the United States to Moscow during the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he was Reagan's choice as ambassador. And he was the person that Reagan chose to brief him on things Russian before all the great celebrated meetings with Gorbachev. And Jack Matlock actually wrote a blog post in the form of a sort of open letter where he said, basically in a much more elegant way, what I've just told you, which is, what on earth is the job of an ambassador and a job of people in a political team who've either just been elected or may be elected if it's not to establish and maintain these contacts? So the question that sort of arises from all this is, you know, I've given you, as it were, the contrarian version, saying basically, I don't believe this, I don't believe that. That the evidence for a whole load of assumptions simply isn't there. Why has this version, which is not my version, why has this version taken hold so comprehensively? Why is it universally accepted? Why is it not questioned more often? And I think one of the reasons is that because it plays into all the assumptions and all the negative stereotypes about Russia, that Russia must be up to no good. And here is, you know, yet more evidence that Russia really isn't up to any good. So you've got a sort of circular argument that reinforces itself each time it goes around. The other reason, I think, is that there is in the Washington establishment, both among Democrats, because Obama really didn't get on with the Russians or with Putin, but especially among Republicans, there is a lot of apprehension and a lot of opposition to the idea that Trump wanted to improve relations with Russia. Now, I mean, I would say, with Trump, I regret to say, that actually improving relations with Russia, so long as you're not making absolutely absurd concessions, is actually something that ought to happen. The current state of affairs is a complete catastrophe, and it must surely be possible for somehow better communications and some better way of operating that would be to both sides' benefit. And I cannot see that there is anything wrong with that particular ambition. But it does appear that there are plenty of people in London, as I said in the Boris Johnson article, but especially in Washington, who really, really don't want this to happen. And so the Russia card, as it were, is a very useful mechanism. And so far, it's actually been quite successful. If you think that if you look at it as it were, the anti-Russia party, so far they've done for the original nominee for National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, who lasted, I think it was 24 days. The Attorney General was threatened but has managed to hold on by the skin of his teeth. We don't know what's necessarily going to happen with that. That several of the senior appointees, including the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, they went to their confirmation hearings in the Senate, and they were asked questions about their intentions and their beliefs about Russia, and they spouted the standard sort of Cold War hostility, which may or may not be their line. But obviously it gave the impression that the Trump administration wasn't going to be as friendly towards Russia as maybe had been thought. So there's a small victory there. And there's a victory in the fact that so far there's been no Trump-Putin meeting announced. You know, I think a lot of us sort of expected that there would be an early Trump-Putin meeting, you know, properly prepared, not too much in haste, but that this would be a good thing. But it hasn't happened. It's obviously been delayed, and everybody wants things to cool down a bit before it's even put on the agenda. So I think we can see that, in a way, the anti-Russia party in Washington, it has scored some victories, and it probably hopes for more. I think that's pretty much what I'm going to say about Trump and Russia, but I'll now talk a bit about journalism. The election of Donald Trump was a huge surprise. It was a huge surprise to the mainstream media here, and it was a huge surprise to the mainstream media in Washington. And I think for many of the same reasons. You know, we called it wrong as we called Brexit wrong. You know, there's the sort of metropolitan prejudice, we don't get out of the capital enough, we don't talk to enough people, we don't talk to enough people who don't think like we do. There's a whole load of reasons why we might have called it wrong, and an extra one might be wishful thinking. But whereas with Brexit in the UK and with Trump's election in the US, the British media basically said, this is terrific. This really gives us fantastic material. We're going to get down. We're going to have a great time reporting. This is a whole new ball game. And in a way, the only people who maybe slightly changed in response to Brexit, I would say, are probably the BBC, who maybe have done more, paid a bit more attention to the places that voted, the places and the people that voted for Brexit than maybe they had done in that particular way before the vote. But the election of Trump in the United States caused something akin to meltdown in the American media. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. What you had was that instead of people saying, isn't this terrific, won't this be a fantastic story for the next however long it lasts, they were saying, oh my goodness, this is a catastrophe for the nation, it's a catastrophe for journalism, what do we do, how do we cover this? And one of the reasons I think that they somehow saw a conflict between their own values, which were obviously not anything that Trump stood for, and giving publicity to somebody who was so obviously out of tune with everything they felt and held dear and the whole business of values. And they seemed very hesitant about covering it. And whether they should cover it in a sort of negative way, or whether they should cover it as a straight, or whether they should cover it in a sort of positive way. And I was just amazed at the sort of high-flown introspection of the American media's response. It was all about them. It wasn't about what had happened in the country. It was all about, you know, what are we poor journalists going to do now? And I think it pointed up, in a way, some of the very big differences that there are between between American journalism and British journalism. One of them is that there is this whole idea that the press, in particular, should be objective, and that there's this supposed Chinese wall between news reporting, which is supposed to be objective, and comment. And the op-ed commentaries, which are obviously from a particular points of view, and there are even different editors on American papers in charge of those things who are never supposed to talk to each other, never compare notes. Now that's not true. Obviously, that's not true in the British press. The British press is very political and very politicised. That most papers take a point of view and expect to take a point of view. In a way, the situation is the reverse in America, because the radio stations and television is more politicised than, say, it is here, where broadcasting is highly regulated. So there is a difference there. Also, there is no equivalent of the BBC, the National Public Radio and PBS. They are not anything. They are minority pastimes. They're not like the BBC. So there is a difference there. So I'm talking more about a bit more about the press than about broadcasting. But I think that of the other reasons why the American press in particular was so much in turmoil was. One of them is that there is extraordinary respect in America for the office of president, or there has been until now. So that, you know, here you would never expect the press corps, the combined might of British journalism at a press conference with the Prime Minister. You would never expect them to stand up when she came into the room. You would never expect them to couch their questions in a sort of respectful way, because this is the president. You would never. There's a sort of tone about covering the presidency and a sort of respect for the office, which really doesn't translate, and it affects all the grades and all the registers. Of the American media, and so it was suddenly, I think, quite a shock for them to see that there was somebody who, in their view, didn't actually warrant that respect, and they didn't know whether to give it or not. There was also the rather amusing day. I think it was very soon, I can't remember whether it was immediately before the inauguration or immediately after, when it was said that Trump was at war with the American media. Now, if the Prime Minister here or anybody in the cabinet or government said, we are at war with British journalists, we would go out and have a drink to it. We would regard that as the highest possible compliment, and we would treat this absolutely in the spirit it was said, and we would go out and wage war with the best of them. American media was horrified. It was as though they'd been sort of disrespected. And I mean, I simply do not understand this. But it was somehow... It was a little bit in the way of the front page here when there was the criticism of the judges on the front page over Brexit, enemies of the people. Personally, I didn't have a huge objection to that, but there were people who did feel that it was completely out of court and it had the wrong vibes, sent the wrong message. But there was something of the sort of unease in that response that there was among American journalists when the president said, right, we're at war with you lot. American journalists do tend to take themselves, I find they tend to take themselves and their calling incredibly seriously. We take it seriously to the point of, you know, huge amount of scepticism, criticism, not wanting to believe what you're told, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. We maybe have too little respect for various officers. And we do take seriously, you know, whether it's sort of mission to explain or mission to try and get at the truth, or we do take that seriously. But I don't think we take ourselves quite as seriously as American journalists take themselves. And the other thing that really infuriated them is the way the Sean Spicer treated them, at least at his first few outings, where not only was he extremely rude to them, which actually Alistair Campbell was incredibly rude to the British press corps when Blair was in office. I was horrified because I was abroad and went to some of the press conferences that were briefings that were chaired by Alistair Campbell. I was completely horrified. I mean, they were vicious and really personal. And, you know, if you were considered an enemy, you either didn't get called or you got actually openly criticised, I mean, personally criticised. So, you know, being rude to the press corps certainly has parallels over here. But Americans weren't used to that. The other thing they weren't used to was having the hierarchy of the White House press corps challenged. So I think under every president that I can remember, basically the White House press corps has sort of managed itself. And there is a hierarchy of who gets called for the questions first, whose answers are sort of given more credence than other people's, that provincial journalists from outside the sort of magic circle of the mainstream press and broadcasting won't ever get called. And Sean Spicer mixed that up. And personally, I think that's a jolly good thing, and it should happen in the lobby more often too. And that's something that I think that now it's starting to settle down, and American journalists are deciding that finally it's less about them than it is about actually getting out there and covering the Trump story as they would cover any other political story. It doesn't seem to me that this presents a huge problem. You know, just get out and cover it. And if you fact check and the facts don't stack up, then put that in your copy. What's the problem? The New York Times apparently is still agonising over whether it uses the word lie, as in lying. And apparently its journalists now have a dispensation to use the word lie on occasion. I actually have more of a problem with that because I think that often Trump isn't actually lying. There's sort of something more complicated going on. But anyway, the New York Times can now say lying, and its editors have said, yes, under certain circumstances, we can say that, even of the president. But I think something else has also happened, which is an interesting thing that's happened. Alan Rusbridger did this rather good documentary about the American media and Trump that went out, I think it went out on Sunday. And he made, I think it was, he made a point about inside-out journalism and outside-in journalism as it applies to politics. And inside-out journalism is what you have when you have something like the White House Press Corps, or you have the number 10 lobby. What you have are journalists whose job it is to cover politics from the inside, who benefit or not from confidential briefings, who associate themselves with the major players, whose job it is really to be part of the inner team. Now, I've never been part of that. The only time when I was even half part of it was when I was diplomatic editor for The Independent in the run-up to the Iraq War. And I hated it because there is this problem about being beholden, the sort of mutual relationship of being beholden to the people who are giving you information and not knowing the quality of that information. I mean, the dodgy dossier on the Iraq weapons is absolutely a case in point, that this was spun in advance of it being published, and that it was that select journalists were given access to it who then felt themselves beholden to report it. And I was very unhappy about that whole system. I regard it as borderline corrupt and not in the interest of free information or even decent reporting. But it has a place, because if you have a sort of insight into how things really work and to who these people really are who are running the country, then there's obviously enormous value in that, and that's how you get it. But the sort of journalism that I've more often done is what Rusbridger, I think, called outside-in journalism, where we look at things from the outside and try and read the runes of what's happening. Obviously, as a former criminologist, that comes to me more naturally than maybe the inside-out journalism. But I think that if Americans in the White House press corps and in the rather incestuous world of sort of top-level American journalism generally, if they are now starting to think in terms of outside-in journalism, not just inside-out journalism, then I think that's probably to the benefit of American journalism, and I think we can actually see. I mean, I've noticed that, for instance, watching CNN, because I was abroad about 3 weeks ago, it was completely transformed. It was vastly more interesting, it was more critical, it was more sceptical, it was more comprehensive. And if Trump has that perverse effect on American journalism, then I tend to think it can only be for the good. So that's everything that I'd like to say, and I'm very happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, Mary. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. There's actually this difference between inside out and outside in journalism. That is one of the things why I think it's so brilliant to have you. I think one cannot overstate the importance of that. And I agree with you that it's borderline corrupt. I actually experienced it as a foreign correspondent, that is a similar experience that you have. As you're not that much part of it. You are, because they're never that interested in the foreign press. But I know from the time when I was a political correspondent back in Germany, when you write the media, they are interested in. And I had people, you might have had similar experiences. People call me up and I just say, I need a comment on that. And then I give you some information. And that is how they try to make it work. Forget about getting paid for it or getting something for freebies. That rarely corrupts you. What really corrupts you is access to information. Mm-hmm. And that is really the difference. You try to be nice to people who give you the inside information. But it is still important, because it tells you in a way that, and otherwise you are have to rely on this criminology. which might be more insightful on the other hand. So, questions, please. Dorothy, yes.
Oh, yeah. I understand that you've sort of downplayed some of the American media's reaction to things that Donald Trump and Sean Spicer has done. But what do you think about the whole accusation of fake news? And if a question is raised that perhaps a politician doesn't like, the new fad is for them is to quite simply brush it off as fake news, and it's quite an easy way for them to divert away from the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things. I think you know, I agree with you absolutely that fake news has become this sort of very useful fad. That it's so easy, just you produce something that somebody doesn't like, and they say, "Oh, fake news," and dismiss it like that. But I also think that the way that the whole idea of fake news sort of came into the vocabulary. I'm just deeply suspicious of this, because I think that the idea of misinformation has been around since whenever, whether it's designed to manipulate or mislead, or I just fail to think of it as a new concept. You know, it's a nice new word to talk about fake news, but I have to say, you know, going back to Russia for a minute. The way that, really since Crimea and Ukraine, the whole idea of information wars has sort of taken off as this whole new concept, as though we're suddenly in an information war. And either we weren't in an information war before, or it's something else that the sort of dastardly Russians are doing that we've got to counter. And I would just say to that, I mean, you know, what did organisations like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, even the BBC World Service when it was broadcasting in foreign languages, what were they doing if not putting points of view that were designed to counter other points of view? You know, didn't we have information wars during the Cold War? Haven't we possibly always had information wars ever since there've been mass media that have a sort of direct send a direct message to populations? But you know, I noticed that people have latched on to the whole idea of information wars, and fake news sort of fits into that, and I cannot tell you how many people are now being funded to look at various aspects of information wars as though this were somehow, you know, tantamount to terrorism as the latest threat on the horizon. And, you know, money that you would never believe actually is available for any other sort of research projects. You say that, you know, you're into information wars. My goodness, you know, the European Union, the State Department, somebody, the British military, somebody from sort of on the fringes of British military sent me an email last week saying he was working on this really, you know, top level project on this, that, and the other, and it was all about. And I was getting really excited. That information was unknown. So yes.
I mean, Trump seems to sort of, you know, get his word out, to put it that way, by Twitter. I mean, how do you think the American media are ultimately going to cope with this and deal with it? Because it comes across as total buffoonery.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I wrote a defence of Trump and Twitter, or at least of politicians using the social media at a time, I think probably a few days after the inauguration, when, because everybody had said, "Oh, you know, he'll stop doing it once he's been inaugurated. He won't do it. He'll be told they'll take away his phone. He won't be able to do it." And certainly, you know, I remember that with George W. Bush, he was one of the first sort of email presidents, and he had his email account taken, or at least, you know, we were told he had his email account taken away, because otherwise he would use it and then, you know, something would get out. And he was told, for the duration of his presidency, he was told, you know, he couldn't have it. He sort of couldn't communicate, which may, you know, given the whole Hillary thing, may have been sensible. But I mean, I have to say that I do rather like the idea of you know, the top person communicating direct to the people in language they can understand, with thoughts that may be, you know, very superficial, wrong, to be rescinded, you know, within hours. But just the immediacy of it and the sort of genuineness. I mean, one of the things, you know, the absolutely scandalous tweet that Trump put out on behalf of his daughter, when, you know, a clothing line saying, you know, you, who was it, one of the sort of upmarket stores had stopped taking her clothing line, that you know, it had so much the authentic tone of Trump that I think, you know, for better or worse, you do actually see something of the guy. So, and I think maybe there was all this stuff before suggesting that he wouldn't do it after, you know, he wouldn't be allowed to do it after he was inaugurated, because it would be too dangerous. But I think in a way it's sort of settled into a sort of register where every, you know, again, the American media went into enormous amounts of sort of soul searching about whether they should report his tweets. And I think, you know, you have to apply the same thing to them. You sort of report them on merit. But, you know, people who see his tweets will judge them as they judge any other sort of tweets that come their way. So I don't have this sort of hugely negative feeling about Trump tweeting. I actually think that maybe more politicians ought to do more tweeting, or more social media anyway.
Isn't it slightly more sinister if he does something like he did recently, claiming that Obama wiretapped him, which is now wiretapped him, whatever that means. But that is basically sending out a claim that it can't be refuted by the out there. So this kind of typical whistle.
I mean, that's true, but I would say two things about it. I mean, one of them you could say, well, I would say that, wouldn't I? Because although, you know, Obama clearly was not was not hacking or bugging anybody, because he wouldn't have, he doesn't, as they said, you know, he doesn't have the power to do it, and he probably wouldn't, you know, would know that this was not a sensible thing to do anyway. But actually, there's been no proper official denial that attempts were made to bug Trump Tower or Trump's headquarters, and nothing. And so, while the actual...
I think put out that they never got the request, and that they've never
yes, it. But the CIA, you know, the CIA is not alone, and there's lots of people who could do this. Apart from the CIA, so you know, you put the CIA, you say, well, the CIA didn't, you know, didn't have any clearance to do it, or haven't put in a request, or whatever. That's fine, but you get them to say that because, say, you've got the NSA, the defense, or you've got a whole load of other people who very well could have done, and there hasn't been, I've seen, any authoritative denial that said that either there was no bugging or there was no attempt made to bug Trump's headquarters.
Nor do we have any evidence on the other side.
No,
I mean,
we don't.
Yes. That we got them to smirky saying, well,
yes,
something always leaks.
Yes, but I also think that because we've had all these tweets, and because the sort of quality of the authority of the information has been doubted so often, that it doesn't have the authority that it would have done, say, half a year ago, if you'd had a tweet like that, it had come from the president. So I think people are taking it maybe a little bit more in proportion than before. But I wouldn't say I would be surprised, but I wouldn't exclude the possibility that there was some sort of bugging going on, whoever authorised it. But that's, you know, that's my nasty, suspicious mind.
Yes, please. Liam, and then Ben,
Hi, I don't know where I heard this from, but there's this idea that, again, to go back to the fake news thing you were talking about a minute ago, that the idea that this war with the media, as you mentioned, it's either the question of whether if the media win and they continue with this kind of narrative of impeachment and scrutiny. If they win, then they have this kind of power. And if Trump wins, then obviously there's kind of questions of the dictatorship. So I'm curious to think about who you think will win this kind of media battle, and what do you think that means in terms of the power that they possess over the other?
I suppose I mean, this is not a very good answer, but it's the sort of answer that occurs to me, that I don't think it's actually, even though it's being cast as a battle between the media and Trump, that it's not a question of one of them winning and one of them losing. You know, obviously losing for Trump is impeachment, because the media gets something that can't be explained away. Winning for Trump would be that the media rolls over and basically says, you know, we're not going to resist anymore. But I actually don't think it's about that. I think that in some ways it's more interesting than that, because I think that the first 3 days that Trump was after his inauguration, he was signing executive orders, you know, one after the other after the other. And I was looking at this and saying, you know, people criticize Putin as though he can do this. He doesn't. Not even Putin does this. This is extraordinary. You know, can you rule America by decree? And of course, you can't. You can't govern America. You can't rule America by decree, because other things come into play. You can issue. You can issue the executive orders. But what we saw with the particular one on banned people from countries, what was it, 7 countries, now reduced to 6, we saw resistance at several levels. We saw resistance, not interestingly, from Congress, but we saw resistance from local jurisdictions, from the states. We saw resistance from the judiciary, as in their judgments, and we saw resistance from the people who went out to the airports with placards and said, you know, this is outrageous, and gave interviews to the media saying, you know, my cousin, my uncle, my whatever, you know, they're all stuck and they don't, you know, what, and this is outrageous use of American power. And what I think we've got going on here, we've got, as it were, an untutored president, somebody who's come from the outside, who is not versed in the ways of being a president of the United States. But you also have, you know, all the things that we learn about checks and balances in the American Constitution, about how you've got the executive, you've got the legislature, you've got the judiciary, and you've got these things can be played against each other. And I think what we're seeing now is something really, really interesting. We're seeing the Constitution being tested in a way that, you know, I don't remember it being tested. It was tested, I mean, I was a correspondent in Washington during the Tide election, when basically there was the whole question of the balance of the vote rested in Florida. Nobody could do a proper recount in Florida because of the idiotic voting system, and the whole thing went up to the Supreme Court. And there you saw the testing of the Constitution in a slightly different way, in that there were provisions for what should happen next. And, you know, all of us were going around with mini copies of the Constitution in our bags to see what should happen next. And it stood up remarkably well to what, in fact, was an idiotic situation. You know, it should have been possible to have a recount. But that was really procedural. Mostly about procedure, not about sort of values and the power of the presidency. And what we're seeing now is testing how much power a president really has and who can exercise the constraints on it. And I think, you know, it's being tested with the executive order on the migrants and visas. But, you know, we could see it tested further, obviously, with Congress, who have so far looked pretty supine. But there are all sorts of other things which Trump has issued executive orders on, including what we have signed away Obamacare, which is actually not that easy to do. That's now with Congress, and they've got to sort out how to do it. But it does show that, at least so far, the checks and balances come into play, and that the amount of power that that Trump thinks he has. I mean, I sent out a tweet one day saying that, you know, one day Trump's going to wake up and realize that he has more power in America as a businessman than he does as president. And I think, you know, that's we're going to see that in the next few months.
Do you have any more?
Yeah, no, I mean, I accept a lot of what you say. I think that maybe something that is, you know, the whole media world and the media landscape, you know, I'm not somebody who would say that elections have been totally changed by the arrival of social media. I mean, I don't think that they have that amount of power. The idea, you know, that the Arab Spring was created by the social media, but I think it's interesting to see that social media, that they play a part in the whole sort of complex of things that are going on. And there was a time when that particular aspect, the sort of use the word populist in the very narrow sense, not in the sense of around Europe. That voice is there in a way that it wasn't. I mean, I have huge problems with the whole business of the echo chamber effect and people talking to themselves and all that, you know, but that's a slightly different question.
Time for one more question, yes, please.
I wanted to go back to your point to do with, like, independent of what someone thinks, whether there's shady deals going on between the Trump team and Russia. What veracity would you give to? Sorry, that's not the right word. What would you say was the result of people like Senator Sessions, General Flynn, being found to have lied about their actual what's the word?
Hobnobbing with Russians.
what do you think that might have resulted from that, or why they might have found it necessary?
No, I mean, I agree with you that's the question in my mind is exactly the same as your question. Why would they actually lie about this? Because, you know, it seemed to me that it's a sort of, as it seemed to, you know, to former ambassadors and things, that this is an entirely sensible, okay thing to do. And the only thing that I can think of is that because, you know, what I called the Russia card became such a feature of the election.
Isn't the Flynn case very different? I mean, well, yeah, Flynn actually committed treason by promising.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that we know that Flynn actually promised anything.
Did he pretty much?
Because he said that they talked, but that's. I mean, if you're going to improve relations, then you're going to reset.
As long as
relations.
The Nasser administration is still on. In governing, before the next administration took over, he travelled over and talked about sanctions. I think that is pretty much established.
I'm not sure.
But then he lied about it.
Yes, okay. I mean, I think the lying. I mean, if we talk about just in general, I mean, I think the lying is, I can only assume that that's a product of the fact that the whole Russia question became part of the election campaign. And so they realised that this was a sort of dodgy, even if it was legitimate, it was a dodgy thing to be sort of seen to be doing. And so they said they weren't doing it. I don't understand why they were. It doesn't seem like a sensible thing to do. But they obviously thought that it would, that what would happen to what did happen to Flynn would happen to them, and that it would be held against them. Now Flynn, I think Flynn is a slightly different case for two reasons. One of them is that there was this question of him accepting a large amount of money to go and. Now the way it's presented is he accepted a large amount of money to attend a banquet, birthday banquet or something for Putin. I think it turns out that it's not quite like that. He was given a huge amount of money to give a speech at a conference, and then he sat next to Putin. So you know, it's you know, we know a lot of people who get a lot of money to give speeches wherever they give them. So it's maybe not quite as terrible as it looks in that particular respect. But as to whether the whole business of the Logan Act, which is what was brought up, which is what 1799, the Logan Act of somebody with no official status, as it were, treating with the enemy as being against the law. I find it a huge exaggeration. I mean, everybody was citing the Logan Act as though this was a sort of extreme criminal act. And I mean, I think you could say that when it was maybe a private Briton going to negotiate with Hitler or something, you could maybe talk about that as an act of treachery. But the idea of actually sort of sounding out Russian officials about, you know, what their position might be if this happened or that happened, which I think is how. I mean, I really don't see that's an act of treachery or contravenes the Logan Act or whatever. But the only way that it was covered was exactly that. And nobody, I saw two people who actually challenged the use of the Logan Act in that way as a sort of threat against those officials, that they were acting against the law. And I think once Trump had been elected, I mean, you know, these guys were in the team, and it seemed to me entirely sensible to sound out what was possible, and that if it had been, I mean, one of the points that I've if they'd been sounding out, say, the British about the about the consequences of Brexit for the US, or the British talking to somebody in Theresa May's team, which they were, because she sent her two closest advisors. She sent to Washington before he'd been inaugurated, basically to fix up her visit in his first week. And nobody says that was sort of against the Logan Act. But they obviously had to talk to officials in waiting, because you can't get nominated or confirmed until the president's been inaugurated. So I just found it.
That's the difference was that he went against existing government policy as long as he was not with the government.
But I think also, I mean, we can have a good debate here. But I think you could say that Obama, in a way, had he changed his own policy. Anticipating the Trump administration, specifically on Syria, because I think that there was, after Trump got elected and it was known that his policy on Syria was likely to be different, you could almost see day by day the Americans retracting from their involvement in Syria, and their whole language became different. And this was while Obama was still in, but it was anticipating that the new administration would be different. And there's a convention that the outgoing president doesn't do anything during the transition that would restrict the room for manoeuvre of the incoming president. And, I mean, in fact, we can see both presidents misbehaving here in a bad way. You know, we can see the Trump team chatting up Russians, but we can also see Obama expelling Russians in the last few days of his administration, which is absolutely, you know, that runs against practically every convention in the book, that you don't do anything that actually rocks the boat in those weeks. So.
I'm afraid we have to wrap it up at this point. Thank you very, very much for coming. Thank you very much for your questions.
You.
And I think we had a really good debate. Very good.